dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I want to take a few minutes for what is known in government as a point of personal privilege. It's what you do when someone attacks you and you need to set the record straight. In my case, reporters for prominent national publications have gone after me as a way of attacking Donald Trump and his senior subordinates. Matthew Rosenberg of the New York Times, Eli Lake of Bloomberg, Greg Jaffe of the Washington Post, and most recently, Peter Beinart of the Atlantic, have largely ignored the substance of lengthy interviews I've given them in order to vilify me and the work we do at the Center for Security Policy. In each case, it's clear these journalists don't approve of our research and the fact that first candidate Trump and President Trump now have arrived at similar conclusions. As I told each of these reporters, that research has demonstrated several realities. The authorities of Islam contend that the practice of their faith requires abject adherence to a political, legal, and military doctrine they call Sharia. It has a veneer of religiosity to it. By some estimates, 10% is concerned with pietistic practices like how often Muslims are supposed to pray, what they can eat, and the like. But at the end of the day, Sharia is about power, not faith. Sharia has been defined for some 1,300 years by a rendering of it known as the Reliance of the Traveler. This massive book makes clear that the faithful Muslim is entitled, for example, to brutalize women and otherwise treat them as property, murder homosexuals, and kill Jews, apostates, females accused of adultery, and anyone who defames Islam. I impressed upon each of these journalists, as I do with audiences I address across the country. Thankfully, all Muslims do not practice their faith according to Sharia. That is particularly true in the United States, to which many of them came from Sharia-compliant countries to escape its horrors. They neither want to live under Sharia nor impose it on others. That said, there is no getting around the fact that Sharia is a supremacist ideology that commands its adherents not only to practice it unquestioningly themselves, but to compel everyone else, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, to submit to it worldwide. Sharia dictates that the faithful must engage in jihad in one form or another, violent jihad, demographic jihad, financial jihad, or the subversive, stealthy kind the Muslim Brotherhood calls civilization jihad. To the extent that Muslims conform to Sharia, as the authorities of Islam and Reliance of the Traveler demand, they must reject such American principles and values as democratic self-governance, man-made laws, the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution, respect for human rights, etc. Instead, it is their duty to supplant those principles and values with Sharia. For example, according to the Cairo Declaration on Human Rights in Islam, adopted by 56 Muslim nations in 1990, Muslims can enjoy freedoms only to the extent allowed by Sharia. These are statements of fact. Recounting them is not Islamophobia, hate-mongering, racism, or bigotry. Rather, it is essential to an accurate understanding of the threat Sharia poses to this country and to Western civilization more generally. And such an understanding is essential if we are to defend our constitutional republic from those who believe it's Allah's will for them to destroy it through whatever means is practicable. Yet, Messrs. Rosenberg, Lake, Jaffe, and Beinart promote in their respective publications, and to varying degrees, the false meme that pointing out such facts is evidence of hostility to all Muslims. It's said to reflect a desire to deny those in this country their constitutionally protected freedoms and keep those outside our borders from coming in. They are not alone in promoting this phony narrative, of course. According to documents from George Soros's foundation released last fall by WikiLeaks, marginalizing me and others who speak such truths has been a project for his philanthropy. And Muslim Brotherhood fronts, like the Council on American Islamic Relations, which was founded by Hamas in 1993, the leftist Center for American Progress, and the discredited Southern Poverty Law Center, have been among those determined to silence national security professionals and others who are effective in challenging Sharia supremacism in this country and elsewhere. Let's be clear. By falsely accusing me and my colleagues of such views, these journalists are not just discounting the salience of our warnings. They are helping Soros and his minions suppress our freedom of expression and reinforcing what amounts to hate-mongering against us. More importantly, to the extent that such reporters are promoting the fraudulent meme that Donald Trump and his subordinates are being unduly influenced by me or others, and are therefore also Islamophobes, racists, etc., they are seeking to suppress them, too. Indeed, that's the transparent object of the exercise. Reporters and media outlets are making common cause with what's been called the red-green axis for the purpose of neutralizing, if not actually removing from office, the president and his most principled and capable subordinates, such as Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions, Kellyanne Conway, Sebastian Gorka, and Stephen Miller. Time won't permit at this juncture a point-by-point rebuttal of the various spurious charges made against me and others by the aforementioned reporters and their ilk. Let me take a moment, though, to address a new one leveled by Peter Beinart in his hit piece in The Atlantic concerning the so-called denationalization of Muslims in this country. I've never heard this term before, and certainly have never used it myself. Neither have I ever advocated what it evidently describes, seeking to strip all American Muslims of either their nationality or their rights and shutting down all mosques in this country. Here's what I do believe. The Sharia supremacist infrastructure built here over the past 50 years by the Muslim Brotherhood and its fronts, in the form of mosques, Islamic societies, cultural centers, and organizations targeting our government, media, churches, and synagogues, schools, businesses, etc., is an incubator for jihad. We continue to ignore it and the stated purposes of those Brotherhood operatives and their Shiite counterparts at our extreme peril. The first order of business must be to be clear about the threat posed to our Constitution and freedoms by Sharia supremacism. In his August 15th speech in Youngstown, Ohio, candidate Donald Trump made clear that he gets that. Second, we must stop importing more Sharia supremacists. That is a purpose President Trump's immigration pause could helpfully advance. Third, the Trump administration must officially designate the Muslim Brotherhood as the terrorist organization it is. That would create a basis for countering those mosques and front groups it owns and/or operates in this country. Finally, if the foregoing steps are taken, we have an opportunity to encourage the Muslim American community to eschew the Sharia supremacists and their efforts to promote the real denationalization agenda, namely the Brotherhood's practice of demanding non-assimilation in and hostility towards the United States, its culture, and laws. These are the sorts of recommendations warranted by the facts, appropriate to the challenges of our time, and necessary to protect Western civilization. I am proud to espouse them and refuse to be intimidated or silenced by the relentless vilification to which I am subjected. I'm gratified that people who have arrived at a similar understanding of the facts are now in a position to ensure that those facts receive the necessary policy analysis and debate instead of being officially suppressed in the name of political correctness, multiculturalism, and diversity sensitivity. Whatever we call such behavior, our Sharia-adherent enemies regard it as evidence of our submission, which only emboldens them to secure that condition irreversibly through ever more aggressive acts of jihad. The time has come for action in countering the jihad. Despite all the vilification, intimidation, and coercive pressure aimed at silencing those of us at the Center for Security Policy, we will continue to speak the truth about Sharia supremacism and help those in power act decisively to defeat it. Next up, we'll turn to Asia and the first of three discussions about threats emanating from there with nuclear strategy expert Peter Husey. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
On this date, March 20th, 1727, Sir Isaac Newton, one of the world's greatest scientists, died. With his mother widowed twice, he was raised by his grandmother before being sent off to grammar school and later Cambridge. He discovered calculus, the laws of gravity, and built the first reflecting telescope. Using a prism, Newton demonstrated how a beam of sunlight contained all the colors of the rainbow. Regarding the Bible, Isaac Newton wrote, "The system of revealed truth which this book contains is like that of the universe, concealed from common observation, yet the centuries have established its divine origin."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
/1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting, I'm pleased to say, with a friend and colleague who has a real insight into one of the topics that we're going to be addressing throughout the program, namely China
and its nuclear forces, and also those of North Korea. He's one of the country's preeminent experts on these matters. He is Peter Husey. He is the president of Geostrategic Analysis and has been active in Washington for decades, both in and out of government, in helping the rest of us understand what is at stake in these various areas. It's always a delight to have him. Welcome back, Peter. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Frank, very much.
I'd like to just sort of level set with you. We will be talking with Gordon Chang and Claudia Rosette about sort of the strategic implications of what's been happening of late in the Western Pacific. With Rex Tillerson in the region over the past couple of days, it's sort of gotten a fresh look. But give us a flavor, Peter, if you would, of the threat that you currently see emanating from China's nuclear forces and those a-building in North Korea?
Well, Frank, thanks for having me on. Let me give a little different flavor because it's frustrating when you look at China and see people seem to think they don't like North Korea's bombs and nuclear bombs, and we don't like nuclear bombs there, and neither does South Korea and Japan, so there has to be a deal that you can talk to diplomatically. My view is maybe not. Maybe Tom Reed, the former Secretary of the Air Force, is right that in his book, The Nuclear Express, he says China helped create the North Korean nuclear program and sees it as saw it at the time as a tool to make life miserable for us, as well as to, I think, split South Korea from us by having some South Koreans, as you see in the upcoming election there, talking about, oh, we need to accommodate the North Koreans, we need to talk, versus those who want to deploy a THAAD missile defense system or have a stronger nuclear deterrent for the U.S., and then even some people talking about a nuclear deterrent that we would bring back to the peninsula in theater weapons or South Korea building their own.
There's been reports lately that the Chinese have given the North Koreans mobile transporter reactor launchers and even materials essential for their nuclear weapons programs. What can you tell us about those developments?
Well, there's evidence you see in the newspaper. There's public comments about this. There's testimony before Congress. It is clear that the North Koreans have been using the Chinese airspace for delivery of material to Iran and back. We also know that's true of Pakistan. Pakistan helped the North Koreans with its nukes. North Korea helped Pakistan with its missiles. That was detailed by the former prime minister there, Mrs. Bhutto, in her book disclosing it. So this cartel, as you will, of these nuclear bad guys work together. And my worry is, in particular, whatever North Korea can do, it may not be very far long down the road that Iran can do and vice versa. And therefore, this is, I think, the reason we can't get the Chinese to help us is they helped create a Frankenstein, and they thought it would be a tool they could use. But now Frankenstein's out of the lab. And the question is, can the Chinese admit that they're responsible for this and pull that person, Frankenstein, back? Or are we stuck with a North Korean nuclear weapon state? Some people think they have. The Chinese told General Wilson, who's the vice chief of staff of the Air Force, they had over 10 warheads. Some people think they have 20 and have a capability to go 100. Now, you asked in your opening, what about the Chinese? You know, our good friend Henry Sikorsky points out that the Chinese have on the table the ability to produce enough nuclear weapons-grade material to build 1,000 bombs a year. And he says that is part of their nuclear energy program, because we've always assumed that they don't have enough material to build enough bombs, so they have 300 or 200 or whatever the number is. That, to me, is real worrisome on top of the Russian modernization, where the Russians have somewhere north of 2,400, 500 warheads, depending on how you want to count them, and the ability to go to 4,000 or 5,000 if they broke out of the New START treaties.
These are all compelling contextual issues for the next topic that I wanted just to visit with you, which we do each time you join us, Peter, because you also are one of our duty experts on this. What we need to be doing in terms of our own nuclear deterrent in light of these developments. And in particular, Peter, one of the things that we're going to have to overcome is a very protracted period of what I think of as malign neglect of our deterrent forces. Talk about, particularly as an example of that, the position we've gotten ourselves into with respect to tritium production.
Yeah, I think you're right. When I went back and got a 1998 report from the Clinton administration that was done by some of the National Defense University, where I was at the time, basically cheering the two-thirds cut in nuclear deterrent spending between the nuclear posture review of 1994 and 1998 when this report was done, and talking about all the areas in which they take nukes off alert, where they said they weren't pointing anywhere, where they were going to take them out of Europe. And this also was at the end of the Bush 41 administration. That holiday, procurement holiday, as General Hirensack calls it, lasted until just recently, and where we have slowly begun the modernization effort of, but we don't have a new bomber, a new missile, or a new submarine going in the water or in the air or in the silos until probably 2026, 27. On top of which, our good friends Frank Miller, who used to be at the White House and at the Department of Defense, and John Harvey, who's a colleague who was also at OSD, have said we got some problems with respect to tritium production and other elements of our nuclear deterrent, which we have kind of neglected.
Now, remind us what tritium is and why it's so important, Peter Husing.
Tritium is the material that used to boost the explosion in a nuclear warhead, basically triggers it. And we don't produce a lot of it, and the Canadians do, but the other people that do it are the Russians. And I'm not sure we want to rely on an adversary for this. So across the board, we now have a plan Congress has approved to go forward. I would hope in the nuclear posture review that the administration is putting forward, we will accelerate. And I think if you saw the testimony before the House Armed Services Committee of all our major nuclear commanders, they even suggested that General Hyten in particular, who's our STRAT commander, said, you know, why don't we accelerate some of this rather than go with the program we inherited? I hope we do, because Russia is going to be completely modernized, according to Mark Schneider, by 2021, 2022. The Chinese have a similar modernization program, probably going to be completed by the end of next decade. We'll be fully up going in 2035. We'll have most of this done if we stay on track. Hey, I think we ought to get a lot better than that.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, Peter, speaking of the program review that is going to be conducted with respect to our nuclear forces, the president, of course, having said that he wants to put us at the top of the pack, two people who presumably will be intimately involved in doing that are old friends of both of ours, David Trachtenberg, the designated deputy undersecretary of defense for policy, and Rob Suffer, who is going to go into a deputy assistant secretary defense role. With responsible for nuclear forces and missile defense. Tell us very quickly about these two guys and why that could be a very important development in terms of personnel for this new administration and its policies.
David, as you know, has been around a considerable period of time. He's an extraordinarily good thinker on this and an analyst and just top of the line when it comes to knowing what our strategic deterrent requirements are. Rob Suffer deserves a special commendation for being on the Senate Committee on Armed Services and putting together every year a really strong nuclear deterrent and missile defense and space portfolio. And he knows how to get the Senate to go along with what we need to do. And I must say, in the scheme of things, you couldn't pick two better people. And I think that says a great deal about where this administration is going.
Peter, we are way over time. We've got to go. Thank you so much for visiting with us, Peter Husing. As always, we appreciate the work you do at Geostrategic Analysis and here on our programs and elsewhere. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll talk more about what went down with Rex Tillerson's travels in Asia right after this.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese leadership may be concluding it can treat the Trump administration the same way it did President Obama, namely like a doormat. Initially,
President Trump flirted with ending the so-called One China policy, whereby his predecessors, going back to Jimmy Carter, had thrown Taiwan under Beijing's bus. Then, unceremoniously, that idea went over the side. At his confirmation hearing, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson warned that the U.S. might blockade the man-made and fortified islands China is preparing to use to control the Western Pacific. Just before he met with Chinese leaders this weekend, they announced the construction of yet another one. Mr. Tillerson nonetheless echoed China's false claims to want, quote, non-confrontation, unquote, and, quote, win-win cooperation, unquote, in our bilateral relations. That will likely be read as weakness and an invitation for China to act aggressively. We better set them straight. This is Frank Gaffney.
Life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's very good to have with us, as we do each week at about this time, our friend and colleague, one of the most admired and respected national security and foreign policy analysts in our country when it comes to matters involving Asia. He is, of course, Gordon Chang. You can find his writings at the Daily Beast, the worldaffairsjournal.com. Also, his two superb books, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon, so good to have you. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. And I think you're a little bit too kind, but I won't object.
No, not hardly at all. Gordon, listen, you, of course, have been following the travels of the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, through the part of the world that you cover so well. I'd like to get your thoughts on a couple of aspects of this. One is that he said that he viewed the possibility of preemptive military action against North Korea in light of what it is doing at the moment, the increasing threats to its neighbors and to us, as something that has to be on the table. What did you make of that? What do you think the North Koreans and others in the region did?
Well, Tillerson's statement on preemption is really a reiteration of American policy on North Korea, We have said that in the past. So, for instance, Nikki Haley, our new ambassador to the UN, said it about a couple weeks ago, and we will say it in the future. Now, of course, the U.S. is not going to actually engage in military action unless we believe that we are in extremists. And that's because there are 25 million South Koreans who live in their capital of Seoul, which is just 30 kilometers away from the demilitarized zone, which separates the two Koreas. North Korea has the world's fourth largest army, and about 60 to 70% of it is forward deployed on the DMZ. They've got, of course, conventional artillery, but also chemical and biological weapons and nukes. The horrendous death toll would be just too much to bear. So we're not going to actually engage in preemptive action unless we have absolutely, absolutely no other choice but to do so.
One of the things that some are considering as possibly leading to such a no-choice situation, Gordon, is the emergence of the capacity of North Korea to launch long-range ballistic missiles against the United States. To some extent, we're being told they may be acquiring that now, at least the western part of the United States. They certainly have put into orbit satellites that could have a devastating effect with electromagnetic pulse or perhaps other techniques against this country. But a long-range missile test or a stage of such a long-range missile was announced yesterday. Do you think that this is really ratcheting up inexorably in a way that could give rise to the kind of circumstances you're talking about?
Well, North Korea already has three missiles that can hit the lower 48 states: the Taipodong-2, the KN-08, and the KN-14. The Taipodong-2 has not been tested at full range, and the other two haven't been tested at all, but they are based on proven technologies, so they will work. If, Frank, the only thing the North Koreans have not been able to do is actually to mate a nuke to these long-range missiles. But we suspect that they are able to mate a nuke to their intermediate Nodong missile, and that already puts American forces in the region at risk. This is a threat that we really don't have very much time to figure out. And so when Tillerson said that the North Korean threat is imminent, which he did on his way from Seoul to Beijing, we have to take him at his word. We have to understand the urgency of this. And we no longer have the ability and time to have this policy of strategic patience, which the Obama administration had in its last years. There's just no more time left for us to figure this out.
And Gordon, when you say figure this out, I guess the question is, what triggers a step by the United States? Is it the deployment of missiles with these warheads mated to them? Is it the extent to which a missile that's as yet still untested but coming, that is clearly an intercontinental range missile, is now actually in place and ready to go? I mean, what would you anticipate would be the ultimate red line?
Well, in a crisis situation, if we saw them fueling a Taipodong-2, that could very well be that type of situation, especially if at the same time they take their mobile missiles, the KN-08 and KN-14, and scatter them across the country. This is going to be very difficult for us because we probably can't, with reliability, find all of their nukes. So preemption is going to mean that they will launch against the United States. We have inadequate missile defense right now, so we have to assume the loss of hundreds of thousands of Americans. So this is something which no one has really wanted to contemplate. Neither the Bush nor Obama administrations put North Korea at the top of their list. They always were much more concerned about integrating China into the international system than disarming North Korea. And so the Trump administration is faced with some very difficult and troubling choices. None of them are good, Frank. Every path going forward is horrible, but we have left ourselves with no choice but to pursue options that have real costs for the U.S.
Yeah. And costs for the region, too, as well, quite possibly. Gordon, speaking of the region more generally, of course, Mr. Tillerson also went to China. And while there, the Chinese, or on his way in, the Chinese announced that they were going to fortify yet another, rather build and fortify, presumably, yet another island in the South China Sea. This had to have been something of a shock for Rex Tillerson, I would think. But he nonetheless spoke well in a way that suggested a willingness to overlook this decided poke in the eye. Am I missing something here?
No, you're not missing anything at all. And there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, Tillerson employed Chinese phrases when he described the relationship between China and the U.S., and he shouldn't do that for any number of different reasons. But it's somewhat understandable because all new administrations come into office trying to develop a cooperative path with China, and the Trump administration is no exception to that. The real issue, though, is what did Tillerson say to the Chinese in private? People say that it was much harsher, and that would be a good thing. But at some point, the United States in public needs to show Beijing we're not afraid of it by talking in realistic terms. You mentioned that last Monday, a Chinese official newspaper mentioned that Beijing was planning to put an environmental monitoring station on Scarborough Shoal and five features in the Paracel group. The Scarborough Shoal is the real hot flashpoint. China sees this in early 2012, and we cannot let them make permanent an act of aggression. This is where the United States needs to show China, tell China in public and private, that we are willing to use force to prevent the reclamation of Scarborough. This could very well be the flashpoint that everyone has been talking about for decades. But at some point, we have to stop China because we didn't confront them when they seized it in 2012, and they just went out and then made the problem bigger by ramping up pressure all over its peripheral seas. So this is a dynamic we have seen in the 1930s, and it is not a good one. We are now on a spiral downward, and we can avoid confrontation this week or next week, but it's coming, Frank, unfortunately.
I just wondered, knowing the Chinese as you do, what do you think they make of the fact that Rex Tillerson may be saying something to them privately and something very different publicly? Do they discount what he's saying privately, or do they discount what he's saying publicly? And again, how might that factor into Chinese calculations for further aggressive behavior?
Well, these days it's hard to figure out what the Chinese are thinking, but I would assume that they understand that the private message is the real one. But when Tillerson says something very different in public, he is making the U.S. look duplicitous in their eyes, because we are not going to respect their core interests and other things that Tillerson signaled in public. And therefore, that's not good. I mean, the United States should have one message. It should be delivered in public and in private. We have backed ourselves in a situation where we have no choice but to do this if we want to protect the American homeland. And we need to show, as I mentioned, that we are willing to stand up for our interests, those of our friends and allies, and indeed for the rest of the international community. And if we don't say that in public, the Chinese will think that we're still afraid of them.
Gordon Chang, thank you as always for your time today and for the great work you do at The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, Fox News, World Affairs Journal, and elsewhere. Next up, we'll be talking with Claudia Rosette. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the Global Jihad Movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Any Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Any Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is so good to have with us Claudia Rosette, one of the country's great investigative reporters and one of the people that we've turned to on so many subjects of interest, in particular drawing on her extraordinary experience reporting from foreign posts, including in Moscow and in China, notably for the Wall Street Journal and its editorial page. These days, she is a columnist with Forbes.com. She also blogs for PJ Media and is a contributing editor of the New York Sun. And we're pleased to catch up with her from time to time, including the moment in Hong Kong, as I understand it. Claudia, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, I'm glad to catch up with you over there for the moment because this gives you a ringside seat on something we were just discussing with Gordon Chang, and I'd sort of like to get your second opinion on it, if I could. Specifically, the kinds of remarks and interactions that our Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has been having in the region, notably during his visits to Japan and South Korea and lastly China, where he talked about both U.S.-Chinese relations and the state of play with respect to North Korea. Give us your thoughts on both, if you would.
Yeah, well, it all connects here. The North Korea has spent years, not only during President Obama's term, but going back to the second term of President Bush, President Clinton before him, North Korea has spent all that time basically getting the message that nuclear extortion works, that America is not to be believed, will back down. And under President Obama, the message was that we really won't do anything. Because, you know, North Korea had conducted one nuclear test when President Obama took office, and has now carried out four more on President Obama's watch, plus an enormous number of ballistic missile tests, has advertised that it's working on nuclear-launched on submarines as a nuclear launch platform, has, if you go back to 2010, advertised to the world that it is rich in uranium, restarted its plutonium-producing reactor, and so on. In other words, it's been going on all pistons with very terrible projects. And during that time, has consolidated a transfer of power from the late Kim Jong-il to the third-generation Kim totalitarian dynastic tyrant Kim Jong-un. And what President Trump has got to do, what America has to do, is change North Korea's calculus. I think that Secretary of State Tillerson has made a terrific beginning to get out there and say, in so many words, the era of so-called strategic patience is over. Strategic patience was President Obama's policy of doing nothing. And at the same time, we have a budget coming out that says America, that Trump is proposing, America is interested in restoring the strength of its military and cutting back on this, the errant so-called soft power, actually mush power diplomacy,
or
which
non-power.
Does not stop any of the problems. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Non-power, the diplomacy of retreat. All this is a move in the direction of telling both North Korea and China, you need to start recalibrating how you assess what the U.S. will let you get away with.
Well, speaking of China, Claudia Rosette, as Gordon reported, and I'm sure you're seeing from your vantage point close at hand there in Hong Kong, was given, at the very least, a very public message that sounded an awful lot like the Chinese line, actually. Words lifted from their narrative, in fact, about cooperation and non-confrontation and win-win and all of that. There is, though, some evidence that the Secretary of State was rather more firm with them in his private conversation. I asked Gordon what the Chinese would make, if that's so, of a seeming disconnect, public and private. What do you think the answer to that question is?
I think that's very likely what happened. And what I hope, I don't know, okay, what I hope is that he's giving them a way to save face while at the same time telling them this can't go on. Now, we very often hear that China needs to be persuaded to get on with the program to help out America to get North Korea under control. In fact, even Ambassador Nikki Haley, for whom I have great respect, who's been doing a whole series of terrific things at the UN, but she was talking about we need to get China to help us. I don't think that China is at all interested in helping with North America deal with North Korea. North Korea is a very useful, constant thorn and irritation for the United States, a threat to the United States. I don't think that it's a threat to China. China would not hesitate if it had to do something to stop Kim Jong-un. And if you think about it, the last country that Kim Jong-un would have an incentive to target with any kind of nuclear strike, missile strike, anything, is China, because he would be obliterated. I'm going against the conventional winds of wisdom, but I don't think that China lives in terror of North Koreans flooding over the border if the Kim Jong-un regime collapses. If you look at that border, which some years ago I did, China could shut that down pretty fast. And I don't think they'd hesitate to do it. So you have a problem that for China for years has been saying, yes, we'll help, has been approving Security Council sanctions on North Korea, and then just letting things roll ahead.
Claudia, let me quickly turn to one other topic on which you are deeply knowledgeable. One of the things that President Trump has done, and you've written about it in your column at PJ Media, is signal he intends to cut the U.S. subvention of the UN massively. There's also talk from Secretary of State Tillerson that we're going to throttle back on our involvement with the UN Human Rights Council, one of the particularly odious UN operations, over apparently its behavior towards Israel. Nikki Haley has been putting a lot of markers down, as you say. Give us a sense of where you think things stand, and more to the point, where they should go from here with respect to the United Nations.
Well, let me see if I can draw a distinction here. Between what it is that the U.S. is doing now and where things can or should go, we've seen a series of terrific moves, including the threat or the announcement by the State Department that the U.S. will boycott the Human Rights Council's discussions of its standing agenda item on Israel and the Palestinians, which is used to endlessly beat up Israel. Okay, the U.S. has finally said we're not going to go there for that, unlike President Obama, who joined the Human Rights Council. The thing that I would add is I just published an encounter broadside. It's a booklet, a long essay on this, what to do about the U.N., in which my argument is, and it's what I would argue here, that we really need to start looking in a very serious way for ways around the U.N., over the U.N., to get bypass the U.N., okay? It's very hard to just say shut down the U.N. It's a rhetorical flourish. People call for it sometimes. But to actually start doing something, we need to be looking for other solutions. So my caveat would be the good moves that the U.S. is now making in terms of proposals to cut funding to the U.N. by the Trump administration. The statements that we're not going to be sitting in on these debates that go completely against the interests of America. These are all terrific. The thing to beware of is that the temptation is to say, okay, we need to reform the UN. And I argue that the UN cannot be reformed. It is configured. It was designed from the beginning to be the kind of bigoted, anti-Semitic, tyrant-friendly institution that it has
anti-American,
become.
Lest we forget as well. Claudia, this is a subject for a much longer conversation. I'd like to get you back as soon as you're stateside. Claudia, thank you so much. Safe travels, my dear, and Godspeed. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We'll look forward to talking with you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.